Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Everybody, this is Alex Lindsay, and I am here with the usual suspects. We've got Ron Brinkman. Ron, are you down? Are you down in Hermosa Beach?
In lovely Hermosa Beach. It's not so lovely these days. Had a bit of a cold spell in California.
Now you were just up here in San Francisco for Macworld.
For Macworld, and you had even more of a cold spell up there.
Oh my gosh, it's freezing! Like literally, it's freezing up here. Anyway,
I know we're such whiners.
Oh man! Anyway, my apartment was not built for that. So that's all I got to say. And we also have Mike Seymour. Mike Seymour, Mike, where are you?
I'm in Sydney, and it's gloriously sunny and hot and good weather.
Oh, go ahead. Just rub it in. Just rub it in.
Yeah,
it is summer there.
The other side of the planet thing.
So we took a little bit of a hiatus, but we're back, and we have a great film. I think a great film to review this week, Children of Men. And what were you gonna say, Ron?
I was gonna agree with the great film part.
Yeah. So as a creative endeavor beyond the visual effects, what did you guys think of the film, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really good. And it's nice to see a film that has some really interesting premises and things to think about. And obviously there have been films before, but that have, you know, had a bleak, interesting view of the future. But that whole idea that, you know, what does humanity do when humanity doesn't have a future was fascinating.
Yeah, no, I think it turned out really, really well. I have to admit I wasn't going to go see it, and then Ron emailed me and told me I should.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably my favorite from last year.
Really well done, and I think that when we as we get into the effects realm, I think that it was you know amazingly well done. I mean, not in your face effects, but really a lot of the subtle effects, the invisible effects that you don't even know that you're watching. Truly, Mike, can you give us a little bit of a rundown of what we were actually looking at there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the big telltale sign. You know, we often quote statistics about films. You know, they did 2,000 shots, whatever, and that's somehow used as the barometer of, you know, how big an effects film is. And, well, let me ask you guys, pick a number of the number of effect shots you thought when you were watching the film that you were looking at. Did you think
it was a low count? It would have been pretty low.
As visual effects shots, I think when I was looking at it, what really went through my head is probably somewhere in the whereabouts of, you know, 30 or 40.
Okay. So these are two really interesting aspects to this. The first is that it was 165 shots, right?
Right.
And so you go, well, 165, yeah, I said maybe 50. There you go. Now, here's the really interesting fact. There were only 460 shots in the whole film. So,
which is pretty, yeah.
50 minutes of screen time. 50 minutes of screen time with visual effects. So, let's say the film ran a couple of hours, 50 minutes solid was visual effects. So, that's about half the film.
Normally that kind of running length would be, you know, well over 1,000 shots probably.
Yeah, and they really used the long shots well, and I think that looking at some of the breakdowns that are up on the web, I think that and there's some FX Guide has a pretty detailed breakdown, right, Mike?
Yeah, we both in our podcast where we talked to the guys at Double Negative and CFC, and also in the written story, because we were in London, we got to meet up with the guys that did it because it was of course all done in London.
And there's also, I believe, some there's VFX World also has a fair bit of information there as well. So definitely some good stuff. And when you actually look at these images that's there, and especially in the FX Guide article, and you're seeing the before and afters, you know, definitely a lot of shots that I didn't think of at all. You know, as effect shots. Obviously, at the beginning, you see the buses, and you know that the animated billboards on the buses are going to be, you know, were digitally added. But I thought it was done fairly well. Your opinion, Ron?
Yeah, no, I thought they were done really well, and I also have to say that even that was so, you know, pushed back into the background, subtle kind of stuff, and, you know, absolutely everything they could to just make it, you know, we're setting a world here, but it's not, hey, look at me, and, you know, I mean, it took me a while to even realize that there was stuff on the buses, because, you know, it wasn't really where you were looking, and it's just, you know, it was just great kind of background stuff.
Mike, do you know what they used for the for tracking the stuff into the buses?
Yeah, it was actually pretty interesting. They used a variety of stuff. It comes down to because there was two big sequences effectively. There's the baby sequence, which is an object tracking problem, as well as a 3D track. And then there's the other normal effect shot tracking. And while the buses stuff was hard-ish, the really killer stuff was when they got into the moving vehicles. But generally speaking, it was Bujo and 3D Equalizer, and then some PF track. And
so with the buses, they didn't use any of the Monet from Imagineering?
Not that I'm aware of. It was pretty much tracked on, and they were very complicated shots because you guys, if you saw the film again, would probably find a whole lot more stuff that was going on. For example, many of the street signs and road directions were changing, and I didn't even notice that, you know, first.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying about it being it. I actually did see it twice. I mean, I the first time I watched it was on the Academy screener, and I really just wanted to go back and see it again, just to see it again, but also to see it on the big screen. And it's true. There's, you know, there's all kinds of little stuff that, like you said, signs that change that you wouldn't even have thought would have needed to have been animated, or you know, you could have easily made the case that nobody was going to notice half that stuff anyway. So why bother? But I think, you know, subconsciously you really do pick it up, and it just sets that world there.
Yeah, I was curious because when I saw it, it looked like the perfect case. I mean, we've done a lot of testing and a lot of work with Monet, and it looked like any kind of planar, like straight flat planar stuff, just seems like the kind of thing that that is really easy to be done in that application. It seems like it would be easier than some of the Bujo or Match Mover for the planar stuff, for the stuff like the buses and the billboards. I mean, obviously, when you get into the longer tracking shots, and if I'm correct, Mike, wasn't there a 9.5 minute shot?
Yeah, so what you're talking about is the you're right, is the sort of killer shot. It's the car sequence, and there are, just for people that haven't maybe seen it, there are five actors in a small car. In fact, it's a Fiat, and the shot is taken pretty much from inside the car, looking out the windows, and there's a whole lot of stuff that's going on. There's gunfire, there's chase sequences, there are digital motorbikes added, and it ended up being six takes that were blended into one 9 minute shot. Now, I think as it happened in editorial, they decided to actually cut that nine down, but at one stage it existed as a full 9 minute sequence. And the roof of the car didn't exist, so we got a shot on FX Guide, and you can see that there's a guy lying on the ground effectively in front of the car that's driving for real, and that had a duplicate on the back in case they were reversing. And then the crew, and being the director and the DOP, sat on top of the car. And there was a camera mount coming down from above that was actually sort of suspending the camera inside the car. And that particular sequence was both technically insanely complicated to film, and also, you know, it's one of those shots that you kind of look and it doesn't really occur to you that it's that hard. And then you suddenly go, hang on a second, if I had to do this, how could I shoot 360 degrees inside a car while in an action sequence without green screen and sustain it for this long?
Yeah, and it's what's amazing, you know, for a lot of us, for those of you who haven't done a lot of match moving, you know, 9 minutes of match moving is 150 frames or 200 frames of match moving oftentimes seems like an eternity of fixes, and you're trying to figure out where you can cut 16 frames out here and there. And so something that gets into, you know, you start talking in 1,000 frames or 20, or, you know, that's 20 or 2,000 frames seems incredibly long. And what we're talking about is you know, an order of magnitude longer than all of that. It's really a pretty amazing thing.
And above the car.
Yeah, I think that As much as the effects were amazing, you have to look at it in combination with the cinematography, because it's, Emmanuel Lubensky, I guess, was the DP or DOP, depending on what country you're in. That's the other reason to go see this twice, is to just watch the length of some of those shots and to really see what he's doing with the camera, because I certainly didn't notice. It wasn't until towards the end of the film that I started to realize that they were never cutting. They were never moving away from this stuff. And then once you notice it, of course, you're all over it. But going back and watching the second time, it's kind of breathtaking how daring they were. And even if some of these were sort of pasted together long takes in a couple cases, I know that some of them, was like the long sort of running gun battle scene toward the end, was literally one long take. It wasn't manufactured at all.
Yeah, and the guys had to do amazing jobs tracking those sequences. As you say, the DOP totally and the director totally committed to these shots, because even, I think, about 2 weeks out from principal photography, they had no way to shoot that car shot. And they were just like, we're determined to do this without green screen, and we're determined to do this live. And they didn't just want the camera in the car. They needed the camera in the car, able to move around in the car. On that the sequence you're describing, the battle sequence, they wanted to be in there with explosions going off, and it all choreographed in and out of that van at the side that he runs into. I mean, it's an astonishing, Steadicam shoot.
Well, and I think that one of the things that is, and this is just more of a observation on the industry, is that there is, I think, a push from the larger facilities, the frame stores, the ILMs, the digital domains. Part of their selling point, part of what distinguishes them from a smaller firm, is the ability to tell their director, shoot this any way you want, and we'll make it work. And that's something
We really have crossed that line to where a good sized facility doesn't have to impose too many restrictions on the filmmakers at all. It's just we can do it.
And I think that's the selling point for them, is that they can do these big films with, even if they're, hundreds of shots or thousands of shots, regardless. The big thing is allowing the director to go back to, no, you can't shoot. Because, I mean, like, literally, when you talk to me, if I'm, me and my merry men of, 10 or 15 people putting together a little effect shot, when we talk to the director, it's not that conversation. I don't think you want to pick up the camera and do that right now, because it's usually budget conscious. It is, time sensitive. We have limited resources. And I think that a lot of these big visual effects firms, that's how they're setting themselves apart. And I think they're doing it very effectively. I know that that's a lot of the direction that the Pirates is going in, for instance. But I think that Framestore really dug into it. Now, Framestore did the long shot. Is that correct?
They did the baby, actually.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the breakdown was the baby was Framestore CFC, and then sort of everything else, I gather, was double negative. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah. I mean, and that's also picking up on something that you said last week, Ron, in the Bond film, which is that these guys didn't take the attitude that CG is a dirty word and, we're going to stay away from doing anything computer graphics, because there is the most amazing human-rendered, subsurface scattering 3D baby in this, full-on 3D solution. But they just wanted everything to look real, and they wanted it to look gritty, and they did whatever it took, CG or not, to pull that off.
I have to admit I was fooled by the baby.
Yeah, I mean, it was, so I kept looking, when I was watching it the first time, it was very much a matter of, all right, where are they cutting between, animatronic and real and CG, and I was sort of convinced that there had to be some animatronic in there, but it looked good, and later read up on it and realized that it was all CG, so, I mean, that's definitely a pretty monumental bit of work right there.
Yeah, I have to admit that I looked at it and I thought it was some of the best animatronic work I had seen. I was like, wow, they really, that looks great.
yeah.
But I was, and I partially probably because I was in the mode of looking at it as, there's no way they're going to do that CG.
Right. It's true. We sort of know too much sometimes and just second guess how would you do it?
There's a team of 18 people insane in the tracking department at CFC, and we got to sit down with them when we were there, didn't we, Ron? And
yep,
it's great. I mean, it's you know, I think tracking departments just don't get the credit they deserve. The object tracking on that was just perfect.
Yeah, well, and you know, not only tracking, although it was very difficult, but also just the sort of object removal. You know, you had to remove the animatronic because they did have an animatronic stand-in, so that had to be removed, and you know, the way people were holding the baby had to sort of be redone to react appropriately to the CG element that was inserted. So I can't imagine how much little tiny things were going on around the actor's hands and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's just a lot of paint work. And you know, that really is what makes all this stuff work. We can talk about the larger things, the things like making the baby itself or some of the big effects, but it is, you know, in most of these shots, what really ties them all together, it comes back to that object match moving, the scene match moving, and the rotoscoping and compositing. I mean, it's just those.
Yeah, I suspect that's why, to answer your earlier question, why Monet probably wasn't used even in some of those bus shots, is because it's not quite general purpose enough, and they probably had to do such detailed tracking, you know, to get the camera reconstruction, that it would have probably been sort of a duplication of effort to try and use Monet for some things.
Right. If there was other things you were doing with the shot, I could totally see that.
I suspect that's probably what it was. Mm-hmm. You know, that and just the general sense of, if you've got a pipeline that can do everything, then it doesn't necessarily make sense to set up a secondary pipeline that can't do everything, and you know, have people have to learn two different packages and things like that.
I don't know what you found, right, Alex, with your testing, but for me, the strength in mono is the ability to also capture the reflection. So if it's like a footage under glass, it's a picture under glass. And on those bus sides, they were just green screen. So to a certain extent, if they, you know, I mean, it's like not as if that ability to capture the reflection and replace under it makes mono outstanding, but that probably wasn't.
Well, I think that, I think that it's one of those things that's definitely part of what Monet is really outstanding with. But I do have to say that from the stuff that we've done with, Match Mover and Buju, and we've used those a lot, it's fine. It's not that big of a deal to put, you know, to put these billboards or the sides of buses or anything else in. But what's amazing is just that with Monet, it's just, you know, you're just seamless. You know, you do it so quickly. You know, it's like an afternoon.
It's very
work.
Targeted workflow.
Yeah, for that one thing, for replacing those screens. But definitely, I can see that if there was a lot of matte paintings, or if there was shed extensions, or if there was other things going on in the scene, it wouldn't be the right solution, because you have to figure out what the 3D environment is anyway. So it's not really going to help you to be doing it in some other place.
Yep. And I think that's probably what it was. You know, even just putting something on the side of the bus, there's probably, I bet if you look at most of those scenes, there's a few other little things going on here and there where they needed the camera, and, you know.
I thought that the power station matte painting was really, really good.
Are you a Pink Floyd fan?
Yeah, that was fun, too.
The what?
Are you a Pink Floyd fan?
Yeah, I'm not enough to catch it from the wall originally, but
I totally caught that. It made me smile. That was a good one.
You know, I think that there was something that one of the things that was important about looking at that shot is that when you realize that is a lot of matte painting, is not, a lot of people think of matte painting as, I'm going to paint something from scratch. Or I'm going to build something up. I'm going to, you know, build this model. I'm going to paint on it or whatever. And I think that it's really interesting. A great deal of a lot of the guys I know that do a lot of this stuff, it is a lot of manipulation of individual either plates, you know, a sequence, or just stills.
Yep, existing elements, and really 3D elements too. It's so common. Even, you know, even for guys that are traditional matte painters, they've kind of gotten into 3D, and they'll, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, they'll either put 3D models in, or more commonly, they'll sort of paint, you know, 3D objects or textures that they put on real simple objects to go ahead and put it into the scene, or add a little bit of a post move or something like that. I mean, I think it's probably pretty rare to have, you know, a single still painting that's stuck behind everything anymore these days.
Well, definitely adding, you know, small bits of 3D, but it's, you know, what's amazing is it's also very rare, if you see something that big, to have it really be truly 3D as well. When you're looking at building something in macro, in a big backing scene, you're really looking at this mixture, this 2.5D of someone who's able to manipulate photos, paint to some degree, and build rudimentary models. And that kind of, that skill set, I think, is pretty much the norm for most matte painters at this point.
Yep.
Any other big effects, Mike, that you saw that were particularly outstanding?
Sorry, was that to me?
Yeah.
I guess I'd say the thing for me is I just started becoming obsessed with how I would do the shot, and right. So for me that huge sequence. Actually, one thing that I did think was, and I said this in my podcast, that you know in the bus sequence when he's traveling to the compound, there's right. a dirty windows, and outside is a shot of the countryside, and some helicopters fly by. And I thought, well, they're well-comped helicopters, aren't they? They're moving pretty well. I didn't realize that the entire scene outside the windows were comped in, and it was a full window replace. And I'm really harsh on window replacements. I think that they nearly always got the exposure wrong. The movement is seldom right.
Right.
And yet, I was so happily buying those ones that I just thought the helicopters had been added into the shot as opposed to, you know, the entire exterior. So I guess that's the shot that impressed me.
So that was when they were going to the concentration camp.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of area. And they're in this bus.
And do you know how much of that was? Because I actually heard your podcast before I saw it a second time, and I looked at that scene, and it was, you know, even knowing it was there, I was like, wow, that's
that was all green right. screen. All the bus on. Stuff was green screen.
Wow,
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean,
that was great. Well, you know, and even, you know, even if you take a look at usually the place where it falls apart with like really soft hair kind of stuff, and that held up too. So,
and apparently it wasn't perfect green screen. Nice. There was noise in it and stuff, so, or grain or something.
Wow. I guess those guys know what they're doing.
They, you know, and I think that this is one of the ones where it's really a thankless movie in some ways for visual effects, and I think it's really, this is of all the movies that we pay attention to, these are the kind of ones that I think are really worth really talking about, simply because this isn't the Pirates of the Caribbean or Star Wars or X-Men where we're expecting big visual effects. This is one where it's just totally sewn in. And it's where I think that I'm excited when you see a lot of visual effects done really well to support a movie that just has a great story. You know, and the visual
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as much as we're raving about all the technical aspects of it because we are geeks, I mean, first and foremost, I walked out of it just, you know, thinking I had just seen a great movie.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that the technical side of it was so good as well, it just sort of adds to the enjoyment of it, but... I just thought it was, you know, a fantastic film.
Yeah, very good.
I actually saw it Anything in London, else? And I was walking the streets where it was filmed at about 10 o'clock at night, having seen it. And it was quite freaky because, you know, when you're in a different city, you have kind of radars up because you don't know the area that well. And to walk out onto the streets of where you just seen filmed, it was and such a bleak outlook. It was quite a funny
That's
experience.
That's perfect, yeah. Yeah, I wish I'd seen it when I was there, too. We were there at the same time, and I wish I had also, but...
So, any other final notes there?
Just one sort of interesting note is for me the place where I noticed when I was watching it the first time, the place where I really noticed the incredibly long shots that were going on was during the during that extended battle sequence toward the end. Mm-hmm. And I think the only thing that made me realize it is, you know, early on in that shot, that 9-minute shot or whatever it is, there's this sort of splatter of blood that hits the camera, right? And that, you know, at some point I realized, hey, that's still there. This has been going on for a couple minutes now. And it turns out that, then I sort of forgot about it, but it turns out that happened fairly early in the shot, and they actually ended up deciding to take that little splotch of blood out just, you know, for the reason probably why I caught it was at some point it was going to be real obvious that they hadn't cut, and they didn't, the filmmaker didn't, you know, Alfonso Cuarón didn't want to draw too many people's attention to the fact that it was just one long shot. You know, I mean, he really wasn't trying to do these long shots to show off, you know, something. It was just his sort of decision that it would help to put you in the scene more and just give you a more visceral feel for it.
Well, and it's so complicated. I think people can very quickly underestimate to do a long shot well. It's easy to do a long shot, but it's very hard to do a long shot well.
Yeah, just the choreography that it must have taken to do that.
Yeah.
But if you do watch the blood spot, if you go back and watch it a second time, even that, it doesn't just suddenly disappear. It's just sort of like there's four or five little drops on there, and they kind of one at a time sort of disappear at appropriate moments when you don't notice them. It's nice and subtle.
I think we should also shout out to Gary at Dodgy Cam Systems, the guy that got the technical SciTech Award from the Oscars for the camera rig, because those guys who are building these special rigs that allow, I mean, basically the special effects guys that work with the visual effects guys, you know, I mean, they really do an enormous job. And that guy was building stuff to a 2/1000th of an inch tolerance over 8 feet. And
yeah, well, and you know, I mean, as much as there's pressure in the visual effects world to get the shots done and look right, the bottom line is it's rarely that situation where, you know, you're on set and if it works, you get the shot, and if it doesn't, you're just, you know, you've screwed the entire crew for who knows how long. You know, in visual effects, we have the luxury of, all right, that didn't quite work, let's go back and work on it again tomorrow. And these guys don't have that. That stuff's got to work.
Yeah, I've had that lately. I've been, you know, we do a lot of shooting. We've been doing a lot more shooting, and I know that that's not an area I do deal with as much. And the stress of just being like, this is the time we're going to shoot it. We have all the people here, and you know, and mine aren't nearly as complicated. You know, mine are like 3 people or 10 people or whatever. But it's so much more stressful when you have to, and so much less forgiving. When there's, you have to make it work, and you get one try to do it.
Well, Gary got the phone call from the DOP saying, I'm in London, I want to do this shot, I don't know how to do it, but somebody says you've got this sparrow head that'll work. It's Thursday, the first flight I can get out's tomorrow, can you get it rigged up for me? And he arrived on Saturday morning, and by Saturday lunchtime they were driving around Van Nuys. Jeez. In LA testing the rig out. I mean, obviously it's a crude mock-up, but it was all working. Right. It obviously wasn't inside a Fiat car, but it was, you know, the rig with the big power slides was managing to move the camera around, and it was staying rock steady off the back of a four-wheel drive. And I mean, that's pressure. And then about 10 days later, they were shooting with it in London.
Yeah, I think, you know, I remember being a novice digital artist in this world, trying to figure out, you know, why are these things showing up in the place? Why didn't they just do this right on set? And as you spend a little bit more time on set, you realize it really is a lot of time just cheaper to fix it in post, that you've got to look at the big picture of what's it costing the crew to do whatever they're doing.
Right.
And, you know, lighting a green screen perfectly or, you know, taking a fold out of it or something is often just not worth spending the half an hour it takes to send somebody up on a crane to do something when, you know, yeah, it'll take an extra half a day in post, but that's just far cheaper.
Yeah. And that's, you just have to, someone who understands the entire process can make that, do that math. So the, anything else? Any final notes?
I'll go ahead and predict this is the Academy Award winner for cinematography.
I don't think there was anything else in the same, let's see, what else would win?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't really thought about it too much, but well, I can't imagine.
I have a cynical theory on that, which is the cinematographer that makes actors look good wins, because most of the people that vote are actors. But that's just me.
Well, yeah, there is that.
There you have it.
So I could be wrong.
So I think the next show that we have coming up is Letters from Iwo Jima, and this right, is the sister
sequel
show
or pair with Flags of Our Fathers.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see how Clint Eastwood takes the other side of it, and so we'll be back next week with a new review.
Yes, and hopefully back on a little more regular schedule here again.
Yep. Sorry for that. We had a little regearing, but I think we've got so many movies out in front of us right now. I think we're just going to have to be doing this every week to keep up.
Yep.
And Mike Seymour from FX Guide, thanks for joining us.
It's been fun. Thanks.
And Ron Brinkman from Hermosa. Where can people find out more about what you do?
Digitalcompositing.com probably says a couple things about my book and it.
When are you going to finish your book?
Not until you stop asking me.
Hey, did you get any hits from your shout-out last week?
Some, yeah. Okay. And yeah, we had a few people that that went over there and clicked on it. So
that was an absolutely shameless
bodies
plug
on the other end of this. It was a shameless
That was the
plug
most shameless plug no I've ever heard. There's nothing to
well,
look
there's
at.
There's no revenue on the other end of it, so what? I can't feel guilty about plugging it. If I was selling something, it would be shameless, but this was more, you know, curiosity.
Well, anyway, everybody, thanks so much for joining us. This is the VFX show, and just want to remind you to
keep it real.
Keep it real.